Hey there, Josh Coleman.
Don Larry, how are you today?
I'm well. It's the end of summer. It's a beautiful day here on the East Coast today, and I know that summer's coming to an end. So
yeah,
it's a little bittersweet, but
right.
Good.
Yeah, same here. Beautiful here. We have a couple more weeks left before things get started.
you're at Stanford. It's always beautiful there.
Well, I'm in San Francisco, and it's usually windy and
microclimate
cold, but
change.
It's a boy, but it is, it's, the weather is, Palo Altonian in San Francisco today, so.
Nope, good, good.
Yeah.
So did you hear the president's address to the nation marking the end of combat operations in Iraq last night?
I read the speech, and I listened to some bits of it. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I did read the whole thing, and I watched some select pieces. How about you?
So it's a pretty momentous a passage that we're marking, no?
I guess so. Yeah. Somehow it doesn't feel that momentous, but it is. This is been a very long and in many ways costly war. Of course, just to state the obvious, not all the troops are out of the country, and there will be some more people who get killed there. One thing that the president, that Obama made a lot out of last night, as he should have, and I think we should probably start there as well, is a sense of appreciation,
yeah,
gratitude, if that's the right word, for the people who fought there. I don't know how many people you know who've actually served on the ground in Iraq. I know a couple of people, including
a few,
yeah,
including the son of a colleague who was killed there, Andy Dosevich's son.
Oh, right. That's right. Yes.
I've had a couple of students come through Brown who are veterans of that theater.
Yeah, there's a.
But it's true. None of my drinking buddies' kids have, have been in, volunteered to serve in the U.S. military. Not many of my drinking buddies, anyway. I don't have that many drinking buddies.
True.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
my latte sipping partners.
I know you're being metaphorical, Glenn. I appreciate that. Actually, there is a kid who was one of my our son's closest friends, so I've known him since he was about 5 years old, and he served in Iraq for a couple of years and is back now. And Carlos Madden in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I'm grateful, and as I've told him, very grateful for what he's done. I think a bunch of us who were around during Vietnam really, inappropriately didn't have the right sort of feeling toward the people who fought there. Those of us who were very opposed to the war, as I was, didn't have the right attitude toward people who fought there. I think it's very important to have an appropriate sense of gratitude at the commitment to people who did. So that's, I think, an important place to start. That said, I was, we've talked about this before. I was opposed to this war going in, and don't feel any sense of regret about that opposition, other than the fact that it was ineffective. I think this was not a justified war, and I think the costs of the war were considerable and not worth it. Secretary Gates, in his comments on the war, had a kind of, what can we say, philosophical attitude. He said that he wasn't sure whether it was worth it, and time would tell. I think for me, what was the most important part of Obama's speech was some place where he said, I think in a somewhat subtle but pretty direct way, that he thought that the war wasn't worth it.
He said that? I missed that in the speech.
Well, let me tell you what he said, and that's the inference that I draw from it. He says, this is what I'm quoting from the speech, that throughout our history, America has been willing to bear the burden of promoting liberty and human dignity overseas, understanding its link to our own liberty and security. But we've also understood that our nation's strength and influence abroad must firmly be anchored in our prosperity at home, and the bedrock of that prosperity must be a growing middle class. And then here's the crucial thing. He says, unfortunately, over the last decade, we have not done what is necessary to shore up the foundation of our own prosperity. And then here's really the crucial thing. We have spent over $1 trillion at war, often financed by borrowing from overseas.
I heard that, yes.
This in turn has shortchanged investments in our own people and contributed to record deficits. For too long, we have put off tough decisions on everything from our manufacturing base to our energy policy to education reform. For me, what's, you know, the essential point there is not just the point that's being taken away from this, which is, you know, now that the combat operations are over, we should be focusing. Combat operations are over in Iraq, not in Afghanistan. Combat operations in Iraq are over. We should be focusing our attention on economic performance at home. But also, I think the pretty direct assertion that lots of the economic troubles that the country is now facing are a consequence of the $1 trillion that was spent on this war, which has been a distraction of attention from issues that we need to be addressing in this country. And also, I think it's important to say, issues that we need to be addressing in this country, if you start from the premise that the country has a very constructive role to play in global affairs. So it's not a kind of nationalist idea that we should put, you know, America first, although maybe there's a suggestion of that. It's that we can't do the kinds of things that people would like us to do globally, to play a constructive role globally, unless we do better domestically. And this war has helped to undermine our ability to succeed domestically. Well, so that, I think, is a statement that the war was not worth it.
You're reading it between the, you're lifting up some tea leaves and looking at the ones that are underneath those on top in order to read the tea leaves in order to come to that conclusion, when he might have simply just said, mightn't he, that it was a mistake. But then, of course, that wouldn't be very politic. I mean, he can't say that. I understand that he can't say that. But I'm just wondering how much he can get done given the limitations of what he can say. I mean, the war was a disaster. The war was a fiasco. The war was immorally wrong. The war was a manifestation of unbelievable arrogance. The war toyed with the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. The war was never marketed honestly. We were never asked to sacrifice. There needn't have been the deficit consequences of the war if the American people had been asked to pay for it in the first place. And that might, by the way, have cooled off an overheated housing market and done some things that were good for the economy, not to mention the character of the American people. The war was fought by those among us whose best alternative in terms of the pursuit of an occupation and career was to join the U.S. military. That's honorable service. I'm grateful for those who have served. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying it makes a mockery out of the idea of shared sacrifice or a country going to war when you rely on a volunteer force to do the fighting. So, you know, I'm not happy with the conclusions that we might tentatively draw from inferring between the lines of the president's speech about things that the American people need to hear directly from their mature leadership. Let's not ever make that mistake again. That's my attitude.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, are we going to go to war with Iran out of the same basic morally lazy, self-aggrandizing, imperialistic arrogance that led us into Iraq? Or do we have national leadership that can gather the political support to take the country in a different direction in its relationships to the rest of the world? I heard nothing from the president in his acceptance of the Nobel Prize in Oslo when he had occasion to address the world in a serious way about war. that would lead me to believe, you know, confidently that we won't make the same mistake again.
Yeah, well, let me just say, Glenn, you know, with all due respect and affection for you, as you know, I agree, you know, largely with everything that you've said. But the fact of the matter is that every time Obama says anything that gets into the neighborhood of what you've just said,
yeah,
he gets kicked around by people who say that he's going around apologizing for everything the country has ever done. And as,
yeah,
you know, former Governor Palin said, we have nothing to apologize for, which is an absurdity. It's a piece of confusing patriotism with idolatry.
Yeah.
And I think that this is where I'm going to push back against what you're saying, Glenn. Instead of criticizing Obama for not saying enough, I think what you ought to be doing is directing your fire against people who are imposing incredibly high costs on him every time he says something that even gets down the block in the same city as, on the same planet, yeah, as what you just said. I mean, if he, okay, you know, just let's just, you know, to divert attention here for a second to you know, the celebration of Reverend King this past
weekend. The Glenn Beck Sarah Palin,
yeah,
gathering.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it, you know, if let me put it this way, if the political heat directed against Obama already pretty high, that stove is turned up, you know, it would be infinitely higher if Obama ever said anything like what Reverend King said in 1967 about the Vietnam War.
Oh, I read that speech recently.
You know, yeah, I mean, when Reverend King talked about the country's death wish, you know, when he said that he was opposing the war in Vietnam most fundamentally because that he had a calling that was higher than the calling of,
yep,
nation.
And he said that Ho Chi Minh and Mao Zedong were not his enemies.
Yeah. So, and he said that, he said, speaking as a man of God. And this was,
yes,
a,
yes,
you know, religious revival meeting over the weekend. So I think, I don't disagree.
Okay, Josh, I
with what
criticism
you say, but I really think,
yeah,
you know,
you
got to direct the fire in the right place,
okay,
on this.
I mean, I would.
Why haven't we gone to war in Iran? Why has policy been different in Iran? Because Obama has a strong commitment against militarizing that effort, and he's paying a high price. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, I was just going to accept your criticism, say that,
yeah,
Obama's in a very tough spot, and that what I said about his, you know, you could call it a lack of backbone, but, you know, you could also say prudence under the circumstances. What I said was easy criticism. It was very easy to do. And much harder to create an environment in which the president can, you know, in which Barack can be Barack.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just
The point that I take from what you're saying,
yeah,
there are two issues that I, you know, that I agree are important to distinguish about in thinking about the war. One is the issue about whether it was justified going in, and, you know, Obama said at the time that he was opposed to the war, and he didn't say anything about that really last night, other than referring to the fact that there were patriots who opposed the war and patriots who supported it. My own view about it was, I think, pretty well captured by what you said. I think it was an expression of arrogance. I think it was, you know, a terrible decision. I think it was... Well, I won't repeat what you said. You said it more eloquently.
But we weren't justified in going in, and this is not...
Yeah, I agree.
This is a matter of doctrine, not a matter of domestic politics and how it's going to play over the news cycle. We either were or we were not. Now, I don't think
I agree
were
with you about
you
that.
Agree? Does the president agree? If he thinks we were not, justified, that would presumably have implications going forward as to what we are and are not justified to do going forward. And that's a matter of doctrine. That's a matter of the stance of the United States government in its international relations. And I don't know what a peacemaker would have been elected for if it's not to change doctrine. And if I may just push back,
I don't know what you mean by a peacemaker. Yeah, what do you mean by a peacemaker? I mean, Obama. You mean Obama as a peacemaker?
Yeah, Obama's, I mean, Obama as a peacemaker. Remember how
Obama's
the oceans were going
all
how this was the, we were the ones that we had been waiting for. Well, we're peacemakers. The we, who is the antecedent of that pronoun in that sentence of the president's, are peacemakers, not warmongers.
Obama's attitude all along was Afghanistan is the good war, Iraq is the bad war. And the objections to Iraq were not on grounds of consequences. The objections to Iraq was that you don't go to war, you don't make wars of choice. This wasn't a war of necessity, it was a war of choice. And I think he was pretty opposed to it for more or less the right for more or less the right reasons. But he didn't run as a peacemaker. He ran as somebody who said we took our eyes off the prize and we should have been fighting in Afghanistan. And so when he announced the surge in Afghanistan, what he was doing, I think, for better or worse, I think for worse, but. For better or worse, was doing something that was entirely consistent with what he'd been saying since 2002, and certainly consistent with what he had said again, for better or worse, consistent with what he had said as a candidate in 2008. There was a fight within the administration and about what to do in Afghanistan, and Gates and Petraeus and the counterinsurgency people won the fight, and Biden lost the fight. But I don't think there was anything inconsistent. I don't think, again, for better or worse, I'm not defending the Afghan policy, but I don't know what this point that he ran as a peacemaker and then hasn't
okay.
been acting.
You know, Josh, I don't want to quibble about words. Maybe I just got the wrong impression from watching the candidate. Maybe I read between or underneath too many tea leaves during the campaign and came to some conclusions that were unjustified. Maybe my disappointment is completely without foundation and I should just shut up and be satisfied with what we've got. But I ain't satisfied with what we've got.
Well, I'm not talking about being satisfied. I just, you know, this is, it's important to get the criticisms right. He ran as a candidate who was committed to the war in Afghanistan. There were people who were running who were less committed to the war in Afghanistan. Hillary Clinton wasn't less committed to it, but
let me tell you what I thought about the speech last night. I listened carefully. It felt horribly anticlimactic to me.
Yeah.
There was something, you know, pro forma or perfunctory about it. I had a chill. I felt a chill when he transitioned at that point in the speech that you quoted from the report that he had kept his campaign promise and that we'd ended combat operations and praising the sacrifice and the good works of our troops and taking account of what had been accomplished into a. It felt a little bit almost like politicking to me. I mean, it felt like elections are coming in 2 months, and I can't just be giving a national speech here about fighting. I also have to relate this to the issue at hand, which is the economy, prosperity, and the stability of the middle class. I didn't read it as you did, as a kind of indirect way of saying that the war was a mistake. I read it as a almost kind of incoherency that I hadn't quite heard the end of the first message, which was, you know, a summing up in some way or another of what we learned from the fiasco of the 7 years in Iraq, and at least beginning of the formulation or enunciation of some doctrine about how that would let me be more confident than I am that mistake wouldn't be repeated. I was waiting to hear that, and then I started hearing about the middle class, about the economy, and about the need for us to be strong at home. And I thought, well, muddled.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly reading something more into it than that. I don't think it was, though I agree with you that you know, look, these, you know, Obama's a politician. It's a political speech. There's an effort to say something about a topic about which he, you know, I think ought to be saying a lot more and ought to be doing a lot more. I don't think he is presenting himself, generally speaking, as the great champion of employment at home. I think that's really a shame. But I think the words are there. I think if you read them, what there is the strong, I think a pretty strong statement that the troubles economically at home are tied to having fought this war, and that what we need is a refocusing of attention on addressing these issues of domestic policy, and that's true not only because there are people in the country who are doing badly, but also because to the extent that the United States has played a constructive role globally, it can't play that role if it's you know, facing fiscal and, you know, economic disaster at home. So yes, I agree. The message it could have been a more reflective message on what drove us into the war in the first place. But, you know, I have the feeling, first of all, that he'd be getting beaten up for that, for you know, spending all this time looking backward. And again, with all due respect and affection, Glenn, I think you'd be one of the people who's beating him up for it, because you'd say, well, it's all well and good to replay these fights of 2002 and 2003, but how about what do we do next?
Were you disturbed by his sort of shout out to George W. Bush last night? I mean, some people are saying he didn't do enough to credit the surge as having been the saving maneuver that made it possible to withdraw with honor, quote unquote, from Iraq. But and others are upset that he even mentioned the president at all in a relatively positive light, which he did do during the speech.
I suppose I could get myself disturbed by it, but I wasn't especially disturbed by it, and I was glad that he didn't give credit for the surge. Glad for this reason. He was wrong about the surge.
And Obama
we've
was.
Talked about, Obama was wrong about the surge. And, you know, we've talked about this before when we talked about places where you and I had made errors of judgment, particularly, you know, ideologically driven errors of judgment, that I mentioned the case of the surge as an area where I felt where I was wrong in just the way that, you know, I made the same error as Obama. And I do think it was a ideologically driven error of judgment to think that I knew what was going to happen with the surge because I didn't like the war. That's what I mean by ideologically driven. Nevertheless, I think if you say something about how the surge was a success after all and it's made it possible for us to withdraw now with things being in okay shape in Iraq, no government, but things being in okay shape, what you do is you distract attention from what I think is much more fundamental, which was that it was I agree with you entirely about this, a mistake to have fought the war in the first place. And the consequences of fighting the war were, on balance, really bad. Those two things, those are separate points, but I think they're both true. And I think if you start talking about, gee, how the surge kind of, you know, help things out some, given a big mistake going in and a disastrous set of consequences overall, I think you kind of distract attention from what's more fundamental.
Yeah, though, of course, he didn't say it was a big mistake. He did say he disagreed with the president about the decision to go in.
Yes.
Former President Bush, I mean.
Yes, that's right. No, I was judging. He didn't say that, but judging from my own point of view, which is that it was a big mistake going in, I think it would have distracted attention from the ways in which it was a mistake to have started focusing on whether this... whether exactly the surge worked. And, you know, was it the surge that worked, or was it the Anbar awakening that made it possible for the surge to work?
Yeah.
Was it the surge that worked, or was it finally some recognition after, you know, 4 years of war on the part of the Iraqis that they really didn't want to be having? I mean, the surge, there, you know, there is an argument that the surge gets too much credit for the turnaround, that the surge was a well-timed effort, in fact, to build on some changes that were happening already on the ground in Iraq.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't. It's easy for me to agree with that, but I just think it would have distracted attention from what was really from what's more fundamental. Yeah. Were you bothered by it? Probably not.
Oh. No, I didn't. I wasn't looking for it. I didn't expect anything. And I mean, and what can he say? Because as you say, he was wrong about the sort of tactical merits of the quick build-up to try to, you know, create a more sort of peace and you know, security for civilian sector, and enlisting the assistance of these Sunni chieftains and so forth. He was wrong about the prospect that that could make things better. It did, as a matter of fact, make things better. And in view of the fact that he wasn't going to engage in a full-scale assessment of the war, its political as well as military and economic merits, it would have seemed odd indeed for him to single out one particular piece within the larger strategic undertaking and then praise it for having worked, even though we all believe that he believes that the larger strategic enterprise was a mistake from the very start. Right. So, you know, I was okay with that. I guess I was kind of okay with that. What about Glenn Beck, though? I mean, this is the other thing that went on in Washington recently.
Yeah,
was that 300,000 people? I don't know the number. What's the the number? It was a lot of people out there.
There are sort of three different kind of estimates. One is by somebody who was taking pictures from the air and then estimating crowd size from the air, and they said it was 87,000 people.
Oh,
then there was somebody else who thought maybe there was another estimate that was in the neighborhood of 300,000 people. And then there was the million estimate that I think Michelle Bachmann, I mean, even Beck doesn't think it was that. And Michelle Bachmann, and her evidence is that she was there.
You know, okay. You know, well, I was at the so-called Million Man March in 1995, yeah. I believe it was.
Yeah.
And the crowd stretched from the Lincoln Memorial past the Washington Monument, well up toward the steps of the Capitol. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the headquarters of the march was set up on the Capitol, and so the crowd stretched back toward the Lincoln Memorial. But in any case, it would have been more than just between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument, which is the space within which I believe the Beck crowd was contained.
Don't know.
So that's what I've heard reported. So, yeah. But anyway, a large number of people, somewhere between 87,000 and a million. We ought to be able to narrow that down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
A few people turned out to hear this demagogue. I mean, and the thing is, he had a Christian message, and the guy is a Mormon. And with due respect, with due respect, I've been around a few conservative Christians in my life, okay?
Yeah.
Now, this is not me saying anything about Mormonism. It's me reporting what I have learned from hanging around the likes of, you know, some of the people whose names I'm not going to name,
who are
prominent conservative. I mean, perfectly mainstream, not nutcases at all.
Yeah.
And let's just say Mormonism and Christianity, they see a distinction between the two, okay?
I'm sure they do. So
I don't know how you get a Christian movement led by a Mormon in this country. Again, with due respect to everybody included, I'm really just describing what I understand to be the lay of the land. I'm not endorsing anything.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to get into a discussion of the subtleties of Trinitarianism.
No, we wouldn't want to do that.
And the, you know, three persons in one substance, homoousios doctrine of Christ. But, I think there is, some difference of opinion on what is not a subtle doctrinal matter for many Christians about the
there's
co-equality of the Son and the Godhead that the Mormons kind of they part company.
My point is that I can't take the religious revival dimension of that event seriously as a long-term phenomenon led by Glenn Beck. That's the only point I'm making. Yeah. So I'm a bit at a quandary. What does it signify? Just what's going on here. They say it wasn't supposed to have a political focus. It was supposed to have a, you know, spiritual focus. And yet I somehow can't really believe that there's not deep political significance to this large crowd gathering to hear from this demagogue. And I gather there'll be...
So what do you think there is that's good to be said about it?
What do I think good could come out of it?
Yeah, no, or to be said about this. Do you think there's anything...
I think, following Robert Putnam... Yeah. You know, I think civic participation is a good thing.
Right.
I think people getting up off their duffs, getting in their RVs and heading out to D.C. to gather around because they care about what's happening in their country. How can you be against that? That's what participation in democracy is about.
Right.
Now, this particular crowd, obviously I have some differences with them.
Right.
But if you're asking me to say what would have been good about that, I would say American citizens gathering to, you know, petition, redress, express... commiserate about the condition of their democracy, that's a good thing.
Right. I agree about that. And do you think that they're right to be concerned about the condition of the democracy?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. I agree with that, So we got 2 points.
I don't know about the remedies now. I'm okay with Social Security for the time being. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, we can get to the comma but in just a minute. I think it's important that... it is a bunch of people who care about the future of the country, and it is also true that there are lots of good reasons to be concerned, and there was this arguably, but only arguably, nonpartisan character to it that is a kind of plague on both your houses. Republicans are what it, you know, Glenn Beck said that both parties have sold their souls or something like that. And I wouldn't have used quite those words, but I think there's a pretty widespread concern.
September 2008, right? Bear Stearns is gone. Lehman is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's in a panic. Credit crunch.
Yeah.
Greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression.
Right.
Wall Street going belly up.
Right.
Bailout. We talking trillions.
Right.
So that's a whole lot of zeros.
Yeah.
You turn around and within 2 years, while the Dow is still languishing and while my house is worth about 80% of what it used to be worth, Wall Street looks like it's coming back. Deals are being done.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we're in this... thing, you know, it's not quite a depression, it's a prolonged recession. There was no recovery summer, I can tell you that much, and the prospects going forward are grim. I mean, slow, tepid, languish, these are the kind of words that you think of in anticipating going forward. So, to me, that creates a condition where, forget about left or right, there's just going to be unrest, dissent, and dissatisfaction with what's going on.
Right.
And if you put that together with the fact that we've got a gridlock government that doesn't seem to be able to do anything. Now, okay, Republicans, the party of no, et cetera, et cetera. I agree with you. Divided government here is not working. We don't seem to be capable of actually commanding our futures through our representatives and our political institutions. And I think that's contributing to people's sense of unease. And unfortunately, then it's coming out on the Democrats who are now, you know, you follow the polls like I do, doing dismally.
Yeah.
The pre-election forecast of where the voter sentiment is.
Needless to say, we neither of us agrees much with the views of the people who were gathered. I do think it was... there was something unseemly about turning this into a celebration of Martin Luther King this is the kind of, you know, this was like the big after party, you know, people joining at the after party. You know, these were people who belong, you know, Beck and, you know, Sarah Palin and lots of the people who were there belonged to political traditions that were entirely opposed to everything that King was trying to do, opposed to the use of national power, you know, power of the national government to remedy fundamental injustices. So it wasn't just that they happened to disagree. What King believed was that you really needed an exercise of the power of the national government to remedy the, you know, the evil of racial injustice. And these are you know, people who are gathered there who have a kind of, you know, just very as a rule. I mean, there are a lot of different people there, I'm sure, but the general message was one of hostility to national government. So these were people who are not on the, you know, who don't belong to a political tradition that was on the planning committee of the civil rights movement. They don't belong to a political tradition that was part of the civil rights movement, but now they're, you know, in this, you know, 47 years later, after party for the civil rights movement, but opposed to the, you know, the central political, the central political project of the civil rights movement, which was the importance of using national power.
Isn't the point that civil rights is no longer the issue?
Yes.
I mean, King has been, in some ways, made into an icon. I mean, kind of reduced to a symbol that can be deployed in lots of different ways, right? So we know that people around the world invoke King imagery and civil rights movement imagery in their various struggles, whether it's in Iran or Tiananmen Square or, you know, in Eastern Europe in the late 1980s. Or whatever, you know, and likewise here, you could imagine a movement, a sort of mass or grassroots movement, extolling or invoking King out of this kind of almost kitsch-like, you know, adaptation and embrace of various symbols that lose their historical meaning. And I mean, I'm not endorsing anything that Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin do. I hope I'm not misunderstood here.
No,
just saying their mouthings about King. I take them about as seriously as a lot of other.
I guess I'm making a somewhat. I hope making a point that's consistent with that, but I think somewhat different a point, which is I agree with you that the civil rights project is not the, you know, central political axis of contemporary American politics, nor should it be. That's right. But one of the messages of the civil rights movement, like one of the messages of the New Deal, was that there are some times when remedying a fundamental injustice in the society and addressing real problems that people are facing requires an exercise of the powers of the national government.
Yeah.
And the people who are gathered are opposed to that idea.
No, I get it. King utters, he says about the Southern governor that his lips dripping with the words interposition and nullification.
And nullification.
Which was all about
limiting
federal power to override what the states want to do on the race front.
That's
exactly what these people want to do. They want to be, in fact, they may even use the same words, nullification. They want to nullify the health care bill. Interposition or whatever, they want, you know, the state to have authority over, you know, so you're saying that as a matter
they want
of the
Arizona and Texas to be made,
so they're hypocritical. You're calling them hypocrites, basically.
Well, it's not just hypocrisy. I mean, there are worse things in life than hypocrisy. What I'm saying is that their central message is that national government is the enemy, know, that it, that other than in, from in terms of protecting the security of the country, the message of is that national government, that when somebody says that the national government has a role to play in you know, solving a problem, what you do is, you know, reach for your gun or your state constitution or whatever. It's a sign that, you know, this is somebody who's on the other side. And what I think that they do, well, when people celebrate the civil rights movement, the central message of the civil rights movement was that racial equality had to be a national project, and that's what the Civil Rights Act was about. The central movement of the New Deal was that people needed protection from the contingencies of markets. And yeah. Most people, I'm guessing, not everybody, but most people who were gathered in Washington on Saturday think that Social Security isn't such a bad thing. And lots of them think that Medicare isn't such a bad thing. So they're prepared to celebrate these things after they've been done. They're always at the after party. Okay. But they oppose the instruments that are needed in order to get those things done. So it's not just hypocrisy. It's that their political their political project, I think, is if you followed their political project, we wouldn't have had any of the achievements in which they, among many others, take some kind of rightful pride.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I know exactly what their political project is, except that they don't like Washington and they don't like Obama. Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, I'm pretty sure I know where he stands on, you know, the large questions about the social welfare state and, you know, the role of government. These folks, like you say, they want their Social Security. I assume that by and large they're going to want the government to come to their aid if there's a lot of other, you know, things that can go wrong. And that by and large they wouldn't side with BP. They'd side with the duly constituted, you know, authority of the United States on behalf of the people. Yeah. And they wouldn't side with the fat cats and the bankers. They'd side with the, you know, the populist and so on. I would think that'd be my instinct. But with this kind of culture war politics and this kind of anti-Obama, you know, we're alienated, you know, we want our country back politics, they never even get to the bread and butter questions, you know.
I agree, and I may be reading too much in. I do think that, as you said before, that there is a unifying thread, not just of anti-Obama, but of deep skepticism, understandable. Really understandable. I think, you know, deep skepticism about the effectiveness of the national government in addressing big problems. Who couldn't be skeptical about that? On the other hand, I think there is a kind of hostility to, you know, efforts to address problems at the national level, which hostility is completely at odds with what are arguably the great successes in the country over the past 100 years. So I do think that that kind of anti-national government sentiment is a unifying thread. And, you know, if there are people there who don't feel that way, then I apologize for mischaracterizing their views. That certainly is the impression created. But let's
I just want to say one more thing about the thing, which is that you know, Al Sharpton had a group gather at a high school in Washington, D.C. simultaneous with the Beck March. And it got press coverage, of course. I don't know how many people might have been inside that high school. But the signature image was the Reverend Sharpton speaking and then a group of civil rights leaders holding, you know, hands with their arms across their chests.
Yeah.
Swaying back and forth as they sang. They were aging. With respect, okay?
Yeah, yes.
Looked like an anachronism to me as I looked at it. That was what I thought. I thought, this is out of another time.
Yeah.
I was really struck by the juxtaposition, and I believe there's a lesson, although perhaps a small political lesson in it.
Yeah.
that's what I meant by the civil rights movement being over and that issue having, you know, really had its time and passed. And this event having happened on the day, the anniversary of the King's speech, and it was desecrating the day in some people's minds and so on, and I can understand their sensitivity about that.
Yeah.
But I still thought, as I looked at it, I said, man, on the one hand, Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin are out there in front of the Lincoln Memorial speaking to this huge crowd. And on the other hand, I've got a bunch of cameras in front of a bunch of aging civil rights leaders. And that's not a contest. There's no contest there.
I agree.
You know,
I agree
completely about that. Those of us who are on, you know, you and I and others on the progressive side of things, you know, I mean, Al Sharpton, God love him, but, you know, that's not the future.
I agree about that. I think, I actually didn't read any of the stories about the Sharpton thing because I thought it was, number one, sort of embarrassing.
Yeah.
And number two, it was this effort at, you know, balanced coverage, which I thought was just absurd.
Yeah,
you know,
really.
It's the kind of thing, you know, it's like one person shows up to counter protest and you got to report on the one person.
Exactly.
And that's balanced coverage. It's like, you know, sorry for jumping steps here, but it's like balanced coverage on concerns about climate change. You know, if people shout enough, you got to give them coverage too. You don't make any judgment about the significance of the thing. So I literally didn't read a single story about it. I just couldn't bring myself to. Not because I found it depressing that so few people showed up, but I just thought this is just not where the, you know,
right.
This is not where the action is. And it's not where the action is because I think the big issues in the country are issues about employment, education, energy.
Yeah.
I think Obama got that right in the speech last night, that those are the big issues that we face. And there is a terrible history of racial injustice, and there is a continuing existence of it, and there is the problem of mass incarceration, which you and I have talked about a bunch before. But, you know, I don't think Al Sharpton was there to talk about the problem of mass incarceration. And in any case, the prospects of addressing, I should have said, so the big issues I think are employment, education, energy, and immigration. And I don't think you're going to do anything on the mass incarceration issue unless you make some headway on some of those issues. And I think it's really unfortunate that the signature issue of whether it was 387,000 people or 300,000 people or a million, however many you got, it's really unfortunate that there was not a gathering of comparable size of people saying we need to do something about the employment issue in particular. It's sort of an unfortunate statement about the state of our politics.
Yeah. Listen, Josh.
Yeah.
I'm going to need to go on this end. Kind of
good.
Up against it here.
Okay.
So nice talking with you. I think there's some things we didn't get to, but you know we'll talk again.
There's next time. Okay. Good to talk. Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.